It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Good, because I had the thing.
Okay.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the multiverse that puts the duh in extra dimensional. I am alternate universe Tony.
And I'm alternate universe William.
And this is episode...
Who knows, really?
No, wait, we'll be real quiet right here.
Oh, enough.
Where
to...
they put
oh.
in the game.
Okay.
Oh, look, it's alternate universe producer who has just come home.
I wondered what universe I was in.
You didn't see your goatee?
I was going to say.
You need to look in the mirror, I guess.
The goatee. You know that's a visual gag, and this is an audio podcast. But I appreciated
it. The listeners get me. It's all good.
Well, yeah, they do.
Anyway, here we are.
Yeah.
Oh, we're just...
Excuse me.
We just started.
Right. Yes. For those of you just joining us from the other universe, other people have a hat. It's magical. It has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People were told, write into that email address with questions, comments, topics, things like this. And that hat magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them. Those note cards manifest physically within the hat, and the hat, for some reason, can switch universes at will. So we, whenever those other guys are too busy, to do it themselves, we pull cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored. They let us go usually after about an hour. That's the show.
At least this time I didn't really have anything else going on today.
Yeah, that's a shocker.
Yeah. I almost was happy to find out we were doing it because I didn't really have anything else going on.
Evil happy or just normal happy?
Well, normal happy is evil happy.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
I'll be in a better mood this time, I think, than last time.
How's your life been since the last time? I can't express it in words. You guys understand time doesn't operate the same over here.
Oh, well, you know, the usual stuff. I mean, nothing really outstanding happened.
Same shit, different dimension.
Yeah, basically. That's what it comes down to.
I'm inordinately proud of that, Joe.
What about you?
you know, being evil. Like everyone. See, that's the beautiful thing. I'm really evil. Really evil.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't like doing stuff. But everyone here is evil, so I can just sort of be... That's what... No. The producer is saying she's not evil. The evil producer, you should say, specifying that she's not evil. Probably lying.
Well, yes.
That would be an evil thing to
That's
do.
Right. She says she's not evil, so sort of gain your confidence... And then she does something really terrible.
How evil, yes. So, enjoy that.
It's pretty evil.
Anyway, well, let's just jump right in, huh?
Yeah, we might as well.
All right. This is the hat. This is the steeple. Open the door, and there's all these note cards.
I guess I should have thought of something to talk about, shouldn't I? about our, my week or something, so it would, well.
From what I hear, both versions of William have that problem.
Next time I'll do better. No, I won't. What am I saying? Yeah.
It's like that bit at the end of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern did.
What bit is that?
When they're about to die, and they're in the nooses, and Guildenstern says, there must have been a moment somewhere at the beginning when we could have said no. And he said, we'll know better next time. And the player, acting as executioner, says, until then. And then the floor drops out, and the ropes tauten, and they die.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that movie when I was younger. I still like it.
Blood Sparrow.
Blood Sparrow. Hard out number two.
Calls us Hat Talkers.
Hat Talkers, starring Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, the Hat Talkers. That's from the war.
Yes, exactly. In the war,
mm-hmm.
the Germans kept breaking the codes, but they found out that only people on this podcast could talk to the hat, and the Germans couldn't crack that. So,
right.
But it sucked because there's just the two of us. So basically, one of us stayed at home base, guess who, and the other one
went into the field
everywhere that they ever wanted to have a message.
Because we had to do the hat talking.
It was very slow.
Yeah.
Also, we had to email and then draw it out. It was complicated.
It was. But that was the war for you.
Mm-hmm.
The big one. So what we call it.
To be fair, we call most of them that.
Well.
Does anybody ever call it, that was the little war? I think, like, particularly bad marriages are referred to that way. What does Blood Sparrow have to say, other than to call us
Hat Talkers?
Yeah.
When you go to name a pet, how do you go about it? Well, that's...
I like the phrasing. I like it, yeah, like you go and turn it in or something.
No, it's... You're invited when someone buys a pet, and you are like the village shaman. You go to name it.
Wow.
So, it
that's
is...
some heavy shit there.
It is a fairly elaborate process. Naming a pet, like naming a child, is... a very delicate matter. And I've seen it done. I don't do it because you usually have to take a lot of drugs if you're the shaman, and I don't do the drug thing. But this is the way I understand it works. The shaman takes some drugs. I don't even know what drugs. I mean, do you know? Like,
no, I definitely don't know.
Okay. Some kind of thing that's plant-based, and you grind it up in a bowl and spit in it and let it sit for, I don't know. You drink it.
Why do you have to spit it?
I don't know. That's just what they always do. And we...
It's just so nobody steals it while it's sitting in. This is mine.
There's some... Well, no. I think the scientific thing is there's enzymes in your saliva, see, that help break it down. Anyway.
Biometric security.
So then you go and, you know, you interact with the pet, and what the way the shaman explains it is you sort of... you know, read the aura of the pet, and you sort of get into the spirit of the pet. And, you know, some shamans tell a different story, like, well, this pet was a person before, and now they're an animal, so you have to get in touch with who they were before. Some just say, no, this is just, it's just the soul of this animal, whatever. But
is there butt sniffing?
Well, I've never seen that, but, you know,
I feel like there might be.
I've never seen that, but I can imagine...
Mm.
Because the shaman like gets down on all fours and it's like they become, you know, not the animal, but like the animal's pal, and they sort of communicate with it on some level, and then they lose consciousness after a while, and then when they wake up, they know what the name of the animal is. It works for babies too.
You grew up on a farm and never named a goddamn animal in your life, did you?
As I said, I've seen it done, but I've not done it myself.
I have named some animals.
Nor have I named any babies. You did it like this? You're a naming shaman? Oh.
No. I did it the old-fashioned way.
What? What? This is the old-fashioned way.
I did it the newfangled way.
What's the newfangled way?
Pick a goddamn name.
Just like out of the blue?
Yes.
Well, that's boring. I mean, what you...
We try and get...
City. There's naming shamans all over the place. You hire a naming
there
shaman.
There would have to be.
I mean, even if you don't believe in what the naming shaman... It's so entertaining.
It does sound...
It's amazing.
Fun.
They show up, they're all dressed up in their stuff, and then they drink this stuff that you know they spit in, and the, of course, the rumor is that they pee in it, too, you know, so it's really gross. And they drink it, and they go a little nuts, and they get on, well, if it's a baby, they don't get on all fours. They just do some weird dance. And then they pass out, and when they wake up, they know the name of the baby and or pet. It's pretty cool.
It sounds a little like BillyWitchDoctor.com.
It's really interesting.
Arise, chicken.
You've never even seen this?
Chicken, I have not.
Boy, you're missing out.
I have a thing.
The thing is, I think you could do it.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah, you should do, well, you don't do things.
No.
But you might be okay doing this because you don't even really, you know what I'm saying? You're...
Drugs.
You're tripping, so you wouldn't even know. And you'd probably enjoy
it. I'm concerned about butt sniffing.
I've never seen that happen, but now that you mention it, I've never been to a dog naming. Only cats and a couple ferrets, but never a dog. So a dog might be, you know. Mm. But, well, you know, I can get, I understand. I mean, I would...
Fish, I think, would be complicated.
I've never seen that one. Maybe do people name fish?
Dangerous. Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Nemo. Albert Brooks.
Like I said, cats and a couple ferrets. Well, no.
It sounds like you're doing it right now.
No, I'm trying to remember. It seems like there was one other thing, but it still wasn't a dog, so it doesn't matter.
And a chupacabra, but it wasn't a dog, so it doesn't matter.
Chupacabra.
I have a point of contention with the producer's family. Hey! That is well known and documented. Your family is awesome. They're kind of shitty at pet names.
I don't know what you're talking about.
There was a cat that was sort of a gray, smoky color that they named Smokey. There was a cat that was smaller than all the other cats in its litter that they named Half Pint. There was a very fluffy cat that they named Fluffy. There was a cat that had the coloration so there was like a mask on their face that they named Bandit. There was a cat who the tip of her tail was a different color than the rest of her tail. And they named her Tipper. The producer herself had two cats, one of which was striped like a tiger and named Tigger, and one of which was gray and male and named Gray Boy.
Okay.
I'm
I want to clarify.
I'm failing to see the... Is there a problem here?
It's just boring. They pick... Like, they just pick a random physical feature.
All right, but that's
that.
That's what happens when you don't have a naming shaman. You just that's
no,
what
that's
the best
what
you can do.
For me.
And he always forgets the penultimate one, which happened before I was even born, in which my parents actually named a cat Black and White. Like,
oh,
that was its name.
I forgot about that one. Yeah. And then there was the butterscotch colored one.
No.
She's kind of butterscotch colored. Oh, named Butterscotch. Well, and we, as a team, have done better. I named my cat Twiglet through a combination of things. Partially because he was colored kind of like Tigger. And, you know, he was a little baby, so I was like, it'll be like Tigger's sidekick, and it'd be Piglet. Even though that's Pooh's sidekick, but Tigger didn't really have one. So I was like, it's another Winnie the Pooh character. But also... because that's the name of a snack food in Britain that I was a big fan of, so I thought that'd be fun. So it's sort of, and it sounds like when you mix Tigger and Piglet together, you get Twiglet. You know, that's what it sounded. Ezzy, as we all know. Her full name is Esmeralda. I think we just picked that because it sounded like a very strong-willed female name, and we thought that was good. We like saying Ezzy. Growing up, my pets were named Molly. I don't know why. That was her name. And my cat was named Mitzi. It was a boy cat named Mitzi, which was short for Mitsufunai, which is the name of a character in a song on a comedy album from Hawaii.
All right, so you don't use a naming shaman, but you try to come up with something that's unique and creative. And
sometimes it's just a name
I want to use. There's no real method to it, though.
No. Whatever sort of works at the time.
We have a duck living right at the bottom of our front porch steps.
Okay. So don't call it Ducky or Bill or Quackers or whatever goddamn color it is. Don't use any of those.
No,
Bill's kind of cute. So would Howard be, also.
It's a female duck sitting on a nest. There's like 10 eggs in there.
Well, that makes it even cooler. We did have a female kitten in the same litter that Twiglet was, a female kitten named George.
All right, well, the name of the duck is Eunice. Eunice, all right. Eunice the duck.
All right, I like that.
What? I mean, that's just its name.
Did the shaman tell you that?
I don't know.
Did the duck tell you that?
Kind of. Kind of the duck told me.
You might be a naming shaman.
Well, but I didn't drink any.
Thing, you go find the old hermit out in the woods. He's the ancient naming shaman, and he will teach you the ways of the naming shaman.
But I don't want to drink that stuff.
Tell you about the guy who killed your father, who was a great
naming shaman. But I don't want to drink the stuff.
Later, it is the tool of the naming shaman.
Mm-mm.
Only they can use it.
Yucky.
And
but this has happened to me before.
His ghost will still talk to you and send you to hang out with a little goblin.
I've never named an animal really before, but I have called animals names that just seemed like the right thing to name them.
I do that.
But they're almost always human.
Yeah.
Names that you would call a person. It's not like Spot or Fido or anything like that. It's just
a guy named Fido.
When I discovered the duck and the eggs, it was like the duck told me that its name was Eunice.
I think you're a natural naming shaman.
Please don't say that, because if anyone hears, they're going to try to get me to
listen to your heart.
No. Here's the thing, though. The other adult lives in my house who was fascinated by this duck didn't know that I knew the duck's name was Eunice. And when she announced to everybody, hey, there's a duck in my yard, she called it Matilda.
Well, a little precious, but
that's not the duck's name.
Well, yeah.
It's clearly Eunice.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had a little disagreement about that, but
who won?
No, well, I guess she did technically, because haven't posted anywhere that it's Eunice, so.
Has she posted somewhere that it's Matilda?
That's what I'm saying. Like, she announced on social media, oh, here's the duck. See, this is Matilda. And she showed me, oh, see what I posted on social media? I looked, and she used the name Matilda. And I thought, what, Matilda? No, the duck's name is Eunice.
This is like when immigrants used to come to Ellis Island. And if they thought their name sounded too strange or was too hard to say, they would anglicize it. They're like, no, you're not Eunice anymore. Now you're Matilda.
Hmm. Well, to me, the duck's name is Eunice.
I'm saying that the other adult in your house is racist against ducks. Ducksist.
This duck is really interesting because
I find that hard to believe.
Well, ducks are interesting. We looked it up because we were concerned that the duck being so close. I mean, literally, you go down the steps from our front porch, and you know, there's a sidewalk at the bottom, and the duck is just like, if you just walked off the sidewalk, you'd walk on the eggs. I mean, they're right there.
Don't do that. But
there's some brush there to cover it, you know. But whatever. And we were concerned that because we are so close, or the duck's so close to the house, and whatever, that we would, scare it away, and maybe it wouldn't take care of the eggs, and the eggs wouldn't hatch, or whatever. But we read up on these things and we found out that there's probably little danger of that, as long as we don't molest the duck in any way.
Also, you can eat the eggs.
Oh, no, no.
I've had duck eggs. I don't like them.
Okay, fine, but we want them to hatch.
I don't like duck eggs.
The only thing
something
we're
weird about them.
The only thing we're concerned right. about is after they hatch, if there's any left in there, and there might be, they tend to go bad and really stink up the place.
Quick, eat them.
No, you need to like get rid of them before anything bad happens. But here's the thing. Apparently, and when we get too close to the duck sitting on the nest, and it's not always sitting on the nest. Sometimes it's away, and it'll cover the eggs with something, so when you look in the brush, you can't even see the eggs.
Ooh.
But if the duck is there, and you approach, it will get off the nest and go out to where you can see it. And, you know, what we usually do is, like, we just sort of walk past, and then nothing else happens. But apparently, if you were to approach the eggs or the duck, it would start to act like it's injured.
And what's that about?
Well, so you, as the predator, will think, ah, I don't have to have eggs. I can have this whole duck.
Whoa.
And it you'll follow it for a while, and then before you get too close, it'll fly off. And
whoa.
Hopefully by then you will have forgotten all about the eggs.
That's some next level duck shit there.
Now, we haven't like tried it out because we're not going to do that because that
I'm
going to
drive to your house.
No,
and
no, no, no,
no. Around with
don't
these ducks.
Don't you dare! But apparently this is what they do.
Oh, ducks are smart.
And I believe it because this duck, like all the ducks around here, has a really full goatee, so you know it's got something going on upstairs.
Okay. You know how much I love evil. But evil and smart are not the same thing.
No, I realize that, but a lot of times, you know, it is. A lot of times.
And some really dumb evil people.
Some really smart evil people.
Some really smart good people.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's the problem.
Well, insofar as they're still good, though, how smart can you be if you don't see the sense of evil? But I feel like knowing evil from good is like common sense.
I guess. But yeah.
Well, and honestly, some of that's not intuitive. I think a lot of that has to do with how you're raised. Mm. You need a parent or some sort of guardian, you know, gargoyle, mutated monster, something, that can teach you wrong from right at an early age.
And help you understand.
Yeah, to help you avoid society and, you know, better fit in as a conqueror of people.
Because otherwise you're really prone to make those horrid mistakes of goodness
yeah.
that people are prone to.
And
happens
it spirals.
To everybody. Happens to everybody.
The next thing you know, you're in a comfortable, loving, altruistic family. I mean, you hit rock top.
Yeah, it's...
I feel like I carried the bit slightly too far with the phrase rock top. Just a little. I feel like...
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Mm.
The wrong from right and the evil from good was good. Rock top, nah, I got cocky. I'd like to apologize for that one. It didn't quite...
It sounds like it's just a really uncreative name for, like, a mountain or something.
Yes, or a shitty yogurt topping. It's like, you remember, do you remember Magic Shell?
Remember, it's still around.
But why?
People still like it.
But that's the thing. It's the most basic physics ever. And it tastes like crap.
Oh, I don't like it either, but I know a lot of people
like
do.
It does not taste like chocolate. It tastes gross. And it's not that exciting that something freezes when it's near something else frozen.
Well, hardens. It doesn't really taste cold.
Oh, well, in that case, it's less exciting even then. What is wrong with you people? I loved Magic Shell when I was like 8. And also, when I was 8 and I couldn't hardly get it, I just knew it existed. I tried it a few times. Whatever.
Yeah. I don't get into it
Stop
either.
Stop it, people. Magic Shell abuse is...
Let's draw something else out of that. I hope we answer your question, Buzz Barrow. Do they have naming shamans over there?
These. These one.
That card you've got there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What about it?
He's from Craig.
Craig?
Craig.
Oh.
You know him? Our entire contingent of international listeners at this point?
Yeah, he's from the Independent Republic of Scotland.
Originally, then he moved to the Empire of Slough.
You shouldn't laugh. I know why you're laughing, because there was a big war, a lot of people died and were evil, but it's kind of tragic, really. We're glad he survived it.
So Craig says to us here, he says,
okay,
dear Tony and William, our summer blockbusters too over the top now. I think I just switched from French to Russian a little bit.
I didn't know it was French.
It was trying to be French.
It was some kind of Slavic thing,
slowly,
is what it seems to start out.
I moved east. Our summer blockbusters too over the top now.
Now it seems a little Spanish.
They can just kugi everything. He wrote kugi in all caps.
I don't even know what you're saying.
Kugi. They can just
CGI
kugi everything.
Computer generated image.
Oh yeah. Correct.
So essentially he's asking, are they overdoing the CGI? Is that kind of what he's asking? If we think that it's just CGI fest when you go to a blockbuster movie?
I suppose.
Okay, well, here's the thing.
Oh, there's a thing.
Well, I have a theory about this.
There's a CGI shaman?
No, I have a theory about this stuff. And I've had this theory since long before there was a lot of CGI movies, and I think CGI has only proven my theory to be correct.
All right, what is this theory?
When it comes to art, artistic expressions really of any kind, and I don't just mean fictional stories, I mean, you know, to me, even a nonfiction thing is an artistic expression, because you have to be creative about your, there's a message, there's a story you're telling, even if it's nonfiction. And you can put all of these artistic expressions on a sort of a continuum where you have authenticity on one side and high fidelity on the other.
What?
For example, if you go to a poetry reading, for example.
Okay, I go to a poetry reading.
Go to a poetry reading. That artistic expression, both in terms of how it's being read, what kind of inflections they're using, plus the words they're writing, is very authentic. And by that I mean, speaking in terms of the audience experience, right? You can bring a lot of your own feelings and responses to the experience. Not everyone's going to experience it the exact same way. What the poem means, what the performance means as a whole, is going to be different for each person.
So the performer is not performing authentically. You're saying the experience of a given audience member is particularly authentic.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
In that they are more invested.
Yes.
Potentially.
It's sort of an intimate type of thing. But if you go to a movie, say, that is very realistic, not necessarily even with CGI, but just everything that you're seeing has a lot of realism, and it's very hard for people to walk away from the film with different interpretations of what happened. I mean, there still will be, but there's not going to be wildly different interpretations. I mean, everyone's going to know who the characters are. Everyone's going to know what the situation, the plot was. Everyone's going to know basically what transformation took place with the character. You know, there's a lot less freedom of individual interpretation, because the storytelling medium itself is very as I say, high fidelity. It's very, the person who's telling the story is translating their thoughts, feelings, emotions, message in a way that's very specific and very difficult for a person to not understand almost precisely what the person's trying to say and communicate. So
I find that very intriguing. I'm not sure I 100% agree.
Well, and some of this...
Because I do believe it is possible, although it is a very rare thing, to achieve large quantities of both simultaneously.
No, that's right.
But it has to be very deliberate.
Yes, that's right. So the purpose of creating this continuum, though, is not to make a case about films versus poetry reading, or, as you just put it, whether or not you can't have both. Certainly you can. The purpose of the continuum is the point that I make with the continuum is this. That sometimes when you tell a story, it can be too real for what you're trying to convey. And
I can buy that. Far too many people, this actually comes up a lot in gaming. This is, I think I talked about before, the simulationist versus narrativist.
Mm-hmm.
What you're trying to go for. If you're trying to go for a particular narrative, you can get bogged down in the details.
That's right.
In the reality of it, and it makes the narrative feel false.
Right. Now, the...
Alternatively, if you're just trying to give a I don't want to say simulation, I feel like that's loaded, but you're trying to give a very specific picture, then you want that intensity of fidelity to use.
Yeah.
Because it is not the story, the message per se. It is the image, in a metaphorical sense.
Right.
That you want to convey. I mean, there are valuable artistic reasons for both.
Right. Well, that's my point. What another point I tried to make about this continuum was that you're always. Because I think this continuum is just a permanent part of human storytelling, you're always going... CGI or high-fidelity story is not going to be the be-all, end-all of storytelling. People are always going to use lo-fi stuff to tell stories because that's the way the story is best told. Meaning that you're never going to get rid of poetry, you're never going to get rid of puppeteering, you're never going to get rid of real stop motion because... Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's what's required. For example, if you have a CGI, if you have a film with dinosaurs in it, and you CGI the dinosaurs, that is almost less effective in storytelling the dinosaurs than if you had stop motion. Because you know that dinosaurs... Well, and I'm imagining you're telling the story with dinosaurs in the modern day. You know that dinosaurs don't exist in the modern day. And the more realistic you show that dinosaur in the film, the more it looks like it's existing in the modern day, the less believable it actually is. Whereas, if you use a stop-motion dinosaur, and the craft of using it is actually really good, that has less fidelity but more authenticity, and that actually, for the person in the audience, that actually encourages them to suspend disbelief more easily and engage wonder more easily so that the storytelling is actually more effective with a stop-motion dinosaur than with a CGI dinosaur, in some cases. Because of how the person engages with the story. Mm-hmm. The more fantastical the story is, let me put it this way. The more fantastical the story is, CGI will be really cool at first as a novelty. It's like, wow, it looks so real, because people do want to see it looking real in the real world. But once people get used to it, it starts to get tiresome. And it's like, this doesn't really work as well.
The whole reason I saw Watchmen, which I never thought could be effectively made into a movie, and which, spoiler alert, it can't, was because I saw the trailers, and it really looked like the comic book brought into real life, and I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Mm. And that's why I went. But, and it was terrible. But, well, and I feel, yeah, the novelty becomes a thing, because as more stuff uses that, other stuff becomes novel. People still make movies in black and white, and it's not because the film's cheaper.
Yeah, right.
You still use those devices because that's how you want to convey it, and sometimes because everybody's bored with everything else, and suddenly the old way is more novel. Because this is the problem. A lot of people nowadays, especially when they're making film, their plan is not, am I telling a certain narrative, am I conveying a certain image, am I giving a certain mood. Their plan is, what's going to make people watch and want to keep watching.
Yeah, right.
It's a business now. And then the decisions become very different.
Well, and I just think that I don't think it's just an issue of novelty. I think that the way human beings hear stories, the way stories impact them, it matters where on that continuum, you know, you are trying to put your story.
Okay, then give me. You gave the scenario for the lo-fi, the stop-motion effects, as opposed to CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Dinosaurs, modern time. Give me the scenario where you want CGI.
Well, I mean,
that's the thing. The theory you're putting forth implies that each thing in its place, which also implies that there's a time when CGI does it better. So,
well, okay, for example, I think the CGI in Jurassic Park, if when they made Jurassic Park, they seriously considered anything other than CGI, I think CGI was the right choice for that story.
Why?
Because the whole point is, I mean, it's not. Jurassic Park isn't really so much a lost world story. It's a, we're resurrecting these things and they're living right now story.
Yeah.
It's science fiction. It's supposed to be a spectacle in that high fidelity way. Whereas if it was a lost world story where you're going to an island and there are all these creatures there who never died off, well, that might be a little different if you want to affect a different mood, if you're trying to instill more of a sense of wonder than a sense of terror or horror, or, you know, you almost want that uncanny valley feeling in Jurassic Park because you want people to feel like this was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have done this. But in the Lost World scenario, nobody's done anything. You're not trying to make people feel scared or terrified. You want people to feel like, oh wow, this place is untouched by human beings, and look, you know, it's all still intact. Then you might want to go more toward something a little bit less like that, so that people are more encouraged to be amazed by what they're seeing. Now, of course, people might argue, and I think rightly so, yeah, but people can be amazed by CGI. And that's true, but not as true as it used to be. You know.
I find, and I always like this now, I like CGI when I can't tell they did CGI. And it's rare, and I'll tell you, it's frequently done much more subtly. Like, if you put a giant gargoyle on the screen, I'm going to have a pretty good sense of if it's CGI or if it's a dude in a suit.
Well, this is
or
what
if
I'm,
it's a puppet.
This is what I'm saying.
But weird, you know, facial things or finishings on somebody. Somebody's got circuitry built into their arm,
mm-hmm.
and you CGI that. If you do it right, there have been stuff where I'm suddenly like, oh, wait, that wouldn't have been real.
Yeah.
And I only realized after the fact, and that's very cool.
Yeah, right. That's a great time to use it. And like I said, you know, right now our culture is, even though they're getting a little numb to CGI, maybe.
And sometimes it's cool. Some of the dragon shit they did, Dragonheart, that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Really, I loved that. And, yeah. And they managed to have constant CGI in a way that to me was not disruptive.
Yeah.
And I remember that at the time because that was the first. That was pretty much the first thing that took what Jurassic Park did as an experiment and said, okay, now we're going to learn from what you guys did.
Make a character out of it, a whole character.
Yeah.
And it seemed to work. I haven't seen it since. Maybe it doesn't look as good now, but... So, you know, I think there's always going to be... There are always going to be artists who realize, you know what, CGI is not going to work here. We're going to do stop motion, or we're going to do some other kind of effect. And people are going to know that it's not real... Or whatever, but...
Or we're just going to not fucking show it.
Yeah, or that.
That's how we used to do it back in the day. Don't show the goddamn thing.
Yeah, and work with that kind of storytelling.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think some people... We have a lot of ideas in our culture about inevitability. Like, you know, eventually the whole planet will be one big city. That's how it works. Or we're going to have one world government. Or it's inevitable for... us to have the technology we have now instead of something different. There's a lot of things we think are just inevitable and we consider progress, you know. Like, we live in a time that's progressed from our ancestors who were hunter-gatherers, and there's really no reason to think about it that way. But we do, and I think a lot of people think that CGI is the natural progression, sometimes not just of film, but of art in general. And it's not. It's just one way to tell a story. There are still lots of different ways to tell a story cinematically, theatrically, and all kinds of other ways that will always be with us, because someone's always going to have a story to tell that uses those, you know, older ways of storytelling.
Well, it's the same shit. TV did not kill books.
No.
Movies did not kill live theater.
Nope.
CGI did not kill puppets and guys in rubber suits.
Nope.
And in fact, puppets and guys in rubber suits have also gotten way better.
And when they're used right, they're very cool. I mean, they work great.
Well, less so guys in rubber suits, but puppets.
I mean, some of the stop motion stuff in the earlier King Kong movies were every bit as effective, as far as I'm concerned, than the CGI stuff of the most recent one.
Did you ever see the TV show, I think it's called Face Off?
No.
Sci-Fi Channel. It's one of those reality
TV shows.
That's
the one that...
Special effects makeup.
Well, yeah, but the Jim Henson Creature Shop is like part of...
Oh, is it?
They're part of it somehow.
I've only seen isolated episodes, but that's...
I have heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Up and coming. That, you can see some amazing shit there.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the up and coming people who do practical effects. It's still a very serious industry.
And, well, it should be, because there's still a lot... you could do there. And what a lot of film directors are realizing, you hear them say this all the time, is that we really need to get back to leaning on CGI as absolutely as little as possible, because the stuff looks best when it's real. You know, not doing this green screen stuff where the actors aren't acting against anything at all and we put everything in it post. No. Put as much real stuff in it as you can, only CGI, which you absolutely have to, and that actually looks better than anything they've been making, and I think that's true.
And the problem is CGI has come along to the degree that it's now cheaper.
Well, yeah.
In a lot of cases.
Really?
Back in the day, we gotta reserve a bunch of special effects budget so we can get this one cool CGI effect.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's cheaper to CGI.
Well, yeah, you don't have to build sets. You don't have to. There's tons of things. The actor shows up. They're surrounded by green.
It took a lot of art and computing power.
Yeah.
Now they've got programs. So
then
that becomes a thing. But people will still do it.
It is kind of amazing how it looks. I mean,
sometimes.
Well, like, I didn't like the most recent Star Wars movies that George Lucas made, but they looked good. I mean, they looked really good.
That was what hit me. In Phantom Menace, spoiler alert, shitty movie, there's the giant battle between the Gungans and the droid army. And I'm watching that. Not that interesting. whatever. And I suddenly realize all of that is CGI.
The environment, everything?
The entire, yes. Yeah. What I'm looking at is essentially a cartoon.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was like, wow.
Yeah. Well, and most of the action with the actors was in green screen and stuff. I mean, not very many sets built, not very many. And when you think about that and watch it, it's pretty phenomenal. But it's also flat and not that interesting.
Well, and it's a
and
tool.
It's not just the story. It's
you can't just shove it in there and get quality. You can use it in ways that give quality.
Well, but
it's
also
a tool. You also can't just throw puppets in something and have it be good.
No, that's true. But when you watch the films that he made originally, you can tell that those scenes are full of real stuff.
Yes.
So much so that when he went back and digitally redid this, that, and the other thing, and then put in scenes that weren't in the original, and those scenes must be almost all CGI because he didn't, you know, he didn't go back and shoot those scenes. You can tell.
Oh, absolutely.
You can so tell the difference between a mostly CGI scene and even the digitally enhanced scenes that are mostly stuff. Somehow, no matter how good they make the CGI stuff, in fact, the better they make it, the worse the distinction is between the stuff that's real and the stuff that's not. They simply can't do it.
And the little bits that he didn't fix stand out even.
Yeah.
I didn't ever notice that the land speeder didn't have a shadow until he put a weird wobbly CGI shadow underneath it, and suddenly it looked very strange. I had seen the land speeder so many times, and I'm like, now it looks weird.
I mean, real. I think they just have to admit that no matter how good the technology gets, in fact, the better the technology gets, the worse off you are in terms of making people watching the film realize or feel like what they're seeing is real.
Also,
you've got to have
go
real
back
stuff
and remaster your fucking films.
Well, okay, but this is again long before CGI was used a lot, and people were talking about, oh, well, we'll do computer effects and it'll look real. I had a sense that, you know, there's always going to be something a little off. And I feel this way about virtual reality, too. It just seemed to me that the thing I was observing back in the late 80s and early 90s in computer-mediated interaction was that even though people could go to a MUD or an online gaming environment or a bulletin board or whatever, even though they could go there and completely control the persona that they portrayed to people and had, you know, could be a lot smoother than they were in real life, a lot smarter, a lot wittier, perhaps convey a sense that they were even better looking, whatever. They still wanted to get together with people in real life and possibly totally blow that false persona away, because even that persona they built up that really stroked their ego and made them feel better about themselves wasn't valuable, so valuable that they wouldn't throw it all away to actually have human contact with another person.
Well,
and I didn't think that was a cultural thing. I thought that had to do with digital interaction, that human beings can tell that it's not, quote-unquote, real, and they want the real thing, and they're always going to want the real thing.
I just think that each variant has its place, because the corollary to that is nowadays there's things like Second Life. And its variants, where you get to actually make a person and, mm-hmm. you know, all mm-hmm. that stuff.
Right.
I still prefer my social interaction on the sites that's all text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
That is the interaction I like better.
Mm.
And it's less real, you know, there's not a person to look
at
or whatever. It's all, I vastly prefer that to this day. Because, you know, I spent some time on Second Life. You were there, too.
That's right.
I dragged you there, I think. And eventually I went back and I interact with people on the text-based ones. And it's not better, it's not worse. It's different. And it has its place. And it's why they still exist. There's still tons of those.
No, that's right. That's
still
right.
Tons of those.
But a lot of times, like I say, people, when people interact with digital media, interact with each other via digital media, or they just interact with digital media in general, they get a lot out of it, and sometimes they're satisfied with it, but a lot of times they're not. A lot of times they sense that there's something not, I don't want to say not quite real, but more. The thing about digital media, and the whole reason we have digital media, is you want to control what's happening there. That's what digital media gives you. You know, digital means it's in little bits, which means you can change those bits, you can interrupt those bits, you can alter them. And so everyone has a sense that when you're communicating through digital media or you're someone's communicating with you using digital media, that there's a huge amount of control, an unnatural amount of control. And by unnatural, I mean an amount of control you won't get in face-to-face interaction, that you won't get in any kind of analog interaction. And they sense that, and they appreciate it for what it is, but sometimes that control can feel, as I said, unnatural or artificial, and people crave something that's less controlled. They want something that's more spontaneous. They want something that's more, you know, again, for lack of a better term, natural. And I think that's always going to be true. I think human beings are always going to want that. So, therefore, there's always going to be this digital interaction. There's always going to be digital media, but people are not going to throw away the more analog or the more spontaneous or the more or the less controlled and what I'm calling the more authentic ways of communicating.
It isn't an evolution of the communication. These are all individual branches.
Exactly.
And they all evolve, but they're individual and they all have a place.
That's right. That's exactly right. But again, you know, our culture...
It's not an either or, and that's what people have to do. Oh, this is going to replace this. No, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that the new thing is going to die off.
No. Well,
sometimes they're both there.
But it's like I said before, the reason people even think that this is going to replace what came before is they think about it like that. They think about, well, this is an improvement on what came before. But it's not. It's just a new thing. Like you said, it's a whole other thing. The other thing, all of these things exist kind of on their own evolutionary tree. They serve their own purpose. One isn't coming or improving upon the other.
Well, and I suppose they can to a certain degree, but it's not. It's too drastic a change. You know, if I invent a book that the pages don't give you paper cuts anymore, that might actually be an improvement
itself. I suppose.
But if I invent a TV, it's not a book.
No.
If I invent, and let's be honest, I invent an electronic book. It's not a book. It's different. And I love them. I read them now. And they're here to stay. Real books, I don't think, are going away.
Well, and there's really, this is all built on, too, this notion that books replaced, I don't know, oral technologies. It didn't.
People still speak.
Well, and they also tell stories and pass stories along without writing them down. You know, so...
In podcasts.
Sure. So, yeah, digital technology has its place, but I do think that there's going to come a time where it's used more sparingly because people are going to understand, I don't want this to look, you know, I don't want it to look fake, but I don't want it to look too real. You know what I mean? Things can look too real. They can look too right, too perfect. You've
got
to...
And then you got Polar Express.
Then the only solution isn't to figure out some digital trick. The only solution is, well, let's build this set. You know, let's have real actors here. Let's, you know, that's the only way to solve the problem.
All of filmmaking is just a constant struggle to find a way to eliminate craft services. Someday.
And unions.
Mm-hmm. And craft service unions. In my mind, it's called craft services because it's spelled with a K, and they just read them all.
Craft dinner.
Yes. Macaroni and cheese all the time. Just tables with macaroni and maybe some individually wrapped singles. That's it. What Hollywood is. We should wrap it up.
Okay.
Because I'm very tired.
Okay.
And evil. So thank you for listening. Hopefully next week it'll be in the other, more positive universe. Because we're sick of this shit. People get amazed that they went on for 3 years. And I'm amazed. Because I can barely handle a week every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would give up on this so fast if I was them.
Yeah.
Of course, I'd kill myself if I was them. Anyway, we hope you've enjoyed this and that you enjoy that and... We're out of here.
Goodbye.
Gonna be evil.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.